Welcome and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants will be in a listen-only mode. To ask a question during the question and answer session, please press star one on your touchtone phone. Today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn the call over to Alicia Downs. You may begin.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and thanks again for joining us for today's COCA conference call on human rabies prevention, troubleshooting, prophylaxis. We are pleased to have Dr. Charles Ruprecht present on this call. Dr. Ruprecht is the director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center for Rabies Reference and Research at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, and the chief of the Rabies Program, Division of Viral and Rickettsial Diseases, National Center for Zoonotic, Vector-Borne, and Enteric Diseases here at CDC. The objectives for today's call are for clinicians to review salient features of rabies epidemiology, pathogenesis, and transmission, to gain familiarity and current recommendations related to human rabies pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis, and to discuss selected case examples of rabies prophylaxis management. I will now turn the call over to Dr. Ruprecht.
Thank you, ma'am. It's a pleasure to be with you this day in celebration of our first annual World Rabies Day week. And what we'll do is go through about a third on introduction and review, second part on issues related specifically to rabies pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis, and then ending with issues of some selected case reports based primarily upon some calls that came in as early as this morning and as late as the last week, some common issues that we'd like to address, and then end the conference with some Q&As if we could. Rabies is, of course, an acute progressive encephalomyelitis, and it's one of the oldest infectious diseases that we're aware of. It's been reported in just about every major culture, civilization, for approximately the last 4,000 years. And because of its case fatality rate, which is the highest of any infectious disease, it obviously carries much public health significance as well as veterinary issues. And given its both public health and veterinary concerns, as well as economic around the world, it is obviously a major emerging infectious disease as well as a historical agent. Next on to the etiology slide. We're talking about etiological agents in the family Rhabdoviridae. These are RNA viruses. These are single-stranded negative sense RNA viruses. This is the most important genus lysovirus in the family Rhabdoviridae. We have, besides rabies virus, which is the type species of the genus, at least six other taxonomic species or genotypes. And to show that evolution is dynamic, historically about one new lysovirus was described almost every decade since the 1950s. And in the 21st century alone, we have four new lysoviruses that have been described. And beyond taxonomic significance, this is of concern because almost all of the major human and domestic animal rabies vaccines in the world are all traditionally based upon true rabies viruses, and the further we get phylogenetically from those, obviously they raise some significant issues as regards cross-reactivity. Next, please. In regards to distribution, with rare exceptions, rabies is found all over the world. We don't have any reports historically in Antarctica, and without having any true terrestrial mammals, that's not surprising. It's rather interesting to us that even as late as the mid-1990s, an entire continent, Australia, was purported to be rabies-free, and then, because of issues related to surveillance of Hendra virus, our Australian colleagues were able to diagnose the first reports of other lysoviruses, not rabies virus, but other lysoviruses found in bats. So we have an entire continent that joined the fold in the late 1990s. When you look at some distribution maps, we have to recognize that surveillance is very biased for zoonoses in general, and not surprisingly for rabies. Oftentimes this is skewed towards clinical descriptions in people or some diagnostics in domestic animals, but recognizing that wildlife and in particular bats are the major, both predominant evolutionary reservoirs as well as significant public health concerns in developed and developing countries, it's not surprising that oftentimes that surveillance is less than ideal, and so oftentimes we don't have adequate submissions, nor do we oftentimes even have adequate surveillance systems. This is a dilemma for travel medicine, because people always want to know, what about the rabies-free areas? Well, you know, they're rabies-free, quote-unquote. We can talk about areas that certainly have been able to eliminate dog rabies, which is our greatest concern. These are most developed countries today. Dog rabies persists in most developing countries. Places that we can ascribe to being rabies-free, quote-unquote, usually this is in the largest geographical area in Pacific Oceania. Most islands are rabies-free. For example, Hawaii in the United States, most of the islands in the Pacific, New Zealand, and with the exception of four in the Caribbean, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Grenada, and Haiti, Dominican Republic, a lot of the islands in the Caribbean are purportedly rabies-free. Now, we must have to take that with a grain of salt, stepping back and thinking about the issues of rabies and bats, that being volant, that certainly islands in the Caribbean are no small feat for bats to reach. And so oftentimes, if it's an issue of dog rabies, it's relatively easy to resolve in the Pacific or in the Caribbean, with the exception of those four island nations that I mentioned in the Caribbean. It's less clear or less obvious from the issues of bats, and so obviously one would be concerned of a bat bite anywhere in the world as far as potential rabies exposure. And clearly, globalization issues, as we've known since the days of monkeypox translocation, are obvious ones, and so we would hope that with electronic reporting today, that change in a country's status would be readily recognized and reported and one would be aware of it, but one hopefully should be aware of this problem with translocation and the ease of transportation of rabid animals today, both domestic and wildlife, as far as trying to call any areas truly rabies-free, and so this has to be taken in context. Next, in regards to hosts, we're really talking about all warm-blooded vertebrates. Yes, even birds are susceptible, but luckily only mammals are of public health concern in nature. We have had no recent documented cases of rabies in birds. That's merely a historical issue and certainly is one in context as far as the development of rabies biologicals. Avian species have played a very important part. And we've known about rabies in mammals for several millennia. And we can talk about two large groups of mammals taxonomically, the carnivora, that is those mammals who have specially adapted teeth for eating meat. We just don't mean carnivores, meaning meat eaters, if they're omnivorous. When we're talking about the carnivora, we're talking about a taxonomic group, primarily the canids, the raccoons, the skunks and their allies, the foxes, etc., the raccoons, and the chiroptera, that is the bats. Both not only the very small bats that most of us are familiar with, the microchiroptera, but also the megachiroptera, the large bats, the flying foxes, for example, in the old world. Next, in regards to burden, one has to appreciate that the burden of disease is not just measured in regards to bodies. As concerns rabies, we think that there's a minimum of at least 55,000 human cases. And in the course of this discussion to date, we've had at least one human case in the world. We have to recognize that it's obviously underreported and underdiagnosed. We have to recognize that there are a wide variety of other encephalitides out there. For example, a recent report in EID where several percentage cases that were misdiagnosed as cerebral malaria actually turned out to be rabies cases. So we take that 55,000 as an average. Most of that burden is found in Asia, secondarily in Africa and in parts of Latin America, and even developed countries because of the issues of rabies in wildlife, the issues of rabies in bats, we still have our human cases as well. So we may have tens of thousands of human deaths. And when I talk about a rabies case, by and large, we're talking about a fatality, whether in humans or animals, as opposed to someone, a human or an animal, exposed to rabies virus or other lyssaviruses. More importantly, anytime anyone is exposed to an animal, we're talking about tens of millions of individuals exposed per year. If we think of just the burden of emergency rooms in the United States alone, that if we have 1% or more of people reporting because of animal bites, because of the dog bite issues, luckily the vast majority of these do not have anything to do with rabies, but the specter of rabies needs to be raised anytime we have a mammalian bite. And then obviously, even though we've been able to control and in some cases eliminate canine rabies, that wildlife are especially important in developed countries. Next slide, please, in regards to rabies pathogenesis. We're talking about highly neurotropic agents. These are probably the quintessential neurotropic agents introduced by a bite into the periphery. Entry into the peripheral nervous system by a retrograde flow in the axoplasm, and then either at the level of the spinal cord, or depending upon how they're introduced into the CNS directly. For example, if we think of a small child's head and a large canid, a large dog, a large wolf's mouth, sometimes we can have direct introduction into the CNS. We have replication at the level of the central nervous system, and thereafter this centripetal passage to the CNS, centrifugal passage to innervated organs, most importantly those portals of exit being the salivary glands, where we have then secondary rounds of replication whereby we can have a virus excreted into the millions of virions per milliliter of saliva, and hence the cycle repeats itself. Now oftentimes rabies is thought of to be a poor parasite in terms of parasitic models in general, but we have to recognize that by the time clinical signs develop in the host, the virus has already passed many of its replication cycles and is being excreted actively in the saliva, and hence it's a very good host because it is able to adapt to a very privileged spot, immunologically speaking, and ensconce itself within the scala natura, the height of the mammalian central nervous system, and actually effect its own transmission well before the host appears ill and certainly before it dies. From a viral standpoint, the host is excess baggage. This is one of the reasons why we have observation periods in animals for which we understand their pathobiology, most notably the dog, and in cases where it has been controlled, observation of the dog obviously saves many prophylaxis cases otherwise. Next, please, in terms of diagnosis. Really, it's fairly simple. When based upon a history of a bite by a rabid animal, for which we have laboratory diagnosis, as well as supportive laboratory diagnostics. And we're really talking about inclusions that, at least historically, at the turn of the last century, those intracytoplasmic, intraneural inclusion bodies, the Negri bodies, that are today diagnosed by the gold standard, the direct fluorescent antibody test, for which there's been a new national protocol and for which we undergo regular training. The United States has, objectively, perhaps some of the best surveillance in the world, primarily because of decentralization. We have over 100 diagnostic labs spread throughout the country and have anywhere from 100,000 to 120,000 submissions per year, of which luckily, only 7 to 10,000 turn out to be positive. So many people exposed, many samples sent in, and yet relatively few in comparison actually turn out to be rabid. In humans, we can talk about antemortem diagnostics. In the U.S., we receive, about a case, a suspect case in humans per week. This past week, I believe we had 3 or 4. And so oftentimes these go in peaks and valleys, oftentimes before holiday weekends. We request for postmortem diagnosis in animals, and still the tissue of choice is CNS tissue, particularly the brainstem. In humans, we're looking for serum, cerebrospinal fluid, a full thickness skin biopsy at the nape of the neck for which we'd be able to detect antigen as well as saliva. Next, in regards to clinical stages, we can think about 5 classical ones, that is, that occur after exposure, the incubation period for which diagnosis is not possible by and large. This is the period whereby virus is moving into the CNS. And in worst-case situations, we can think about a week. These are going to be dependent in part upon dose and site and route and severity. And so in very severe situations, relatively short incubation periods. Also, we have some very prolonged incubation periods for which we do not have adequate explanation. In fact, some of the best objective documentation of long incubation periods in excess of a year, as long as 6 years, have been documented in the United States. On average, most of these incubation periods are on the order of about 4 to 6 weeks. Thereafter, we have a very nonspecific prodromal phase where the host appears with almost flu-like signs, thereafter progressing into an acute neurologic phase. Oftentimes at the site of the bite, there may be suggestions of tingling or pruritus from dorsal root ganglion intervention, for example. We also have progressive hallucinatory signs, symptoms, odd acting behavior. Very soon thereafter, there can be cranial nerve deficits, progressive paralysis, ataxia, etc. Oftentimes, historically, people talked about a more furious stage, that is, where a patient was more centrally demonstrating signs demonstrative of maniacal behavior versus a more paralytic. Oftentimes, this is complicated not just by the variant of rabies virus, but perhaps just as much on some host attributes, because in having different individuals bitten, for example, by the same rabid animal, one may manifest with more maniacal, furious, centralized signs as opposed to others with ascending paralysis and more of a paralytic phase. Oftentimes, historically, it's been suggested that particularly vampire bat exposures in Latin America are more of a paralytic. Relatively soon thereafter, the patient progresses into coma, and relatively soon thereafter into death. Obviously, recovery from rabies is very, very, very unusual. Next, please. We have had only 5 documented historical recoveries from human rabies in people who had had vaccine on board before the demonstration of clinical signs. Most of the time, once signs manifest, there's relatively little that can be done. We have only 1 historical survivor, which through heroic medical care that also involved induction of drug-induced coma, antivirals, etc., have we had 1 relatively recent survivor in 2004. Next, please. Human rabies in the United States, we have anywhere from 1 to 8 cases over the last 5 years, so it's relatively uncommon, even though the burden of rabies in animals is not common. Rabies is not a rare disease in animals. In the United States, we live in a sea of rabies, and hence that's what results in 20 to 40,000 potential exposures per year. Oftentimes, we don't know if these are real exposures because the animal may not be available for diagnosis, and so one errs on the side of caution. When we had dog rabies that was rampant post-World War II, we had somewhere between 9 and 10,000 rabid domestic animals per year. You can imagine the number of exposures that occurred when we had enzootic dog rabies. The United States is now free of dog rabies transmission. We were fortunate not to have a single human case in 2007, knock on wood. Most of our exposures still occur inadvertently because of suspect domestic animal exposures. Thereafter, most of our exposures are related to suspect wildlife, such as raccoons in the eastern United States, skunks in the upper and lower Midwest and in California, foxes in Alaska and in the southwestern United States, as well as bats that are enzootic in 49 of our 50 states. And we invite you to go to the professional resources page of the CDC rabies website to look more in depth at our 2006 surveillance report. In regards to defining exposure, really almost all, next slide, almost all human rabies cases are caused by a bite non-bite exposures are exceedingly rare as far as actually causing rabies. We have to go to some extreme examples for thinking about non-bite exposures. For example, in 2004, a transplantation acquired rabies. We have relatively few cases from mucosal exposure. In fact, one has to go back into the literature until the 1930s to find the last bona fide case of mucosal exposure. This was a young girl who was repeatedly licked on her mucous membranes by a rabid dog over several days. Aside from that, we have some purported ones that were acquired in bat caves that had huge aggregations into the tens of millions of bats. These are biologically rare events, and in fact, there are potentially other sources of exposure in both of those cases, as well as at least two cases of aerosol acquisition in the laboratory as far as humans are concerned. Obviously, most of what we have to deal with, I mean the collective we on a daily basis, is not an exposure. Merely seeing a rabid animal, being in the same room with a rabid animal, petting a rabid animal, even though obviously we don't suggest that people pet rabid animals, is not suggestive of an exposure along these lines. And hence, if we were in an auditorium and a rabid bat was flying around us at that time, this is not considered an exposure. And in fact, having just come from a major conference out in Estes Park, we in fact had a bat flying about the auditorium while talks went on all that week. Oftentimes, we're invading their grounds. It's the other way around. We also have to recognize that with bite exposures from carnivores, they tend to be more profound than the lesions that are caused, and so oftentimes the lesions that are caused by the small teeth of bats are oftentimes minuscule. Next, in regards to prophylaxis, we're really talking about two major forms, pre-exposure vaccination as opposed to post-exposure prophylaxis, or PEP. In the old days, we used to refer to this as post-exposure treatment. Obviously, it should be clear that we're trying to differentiate prophylaxis or a preventative before clinical signs as opposed to treatment or experimental treatment modalities such as we've been experiencing ever since the 2004 Wisconsin event, and hence PEP as opposed to PET. The other reason is that people oftentimes may not seek prophylaxis if they hear about post-exposure treatment because they may think, oh, I can be treated for rabies, and oftentimes take this out of context. So you'd be surprised what a difference a word makes. Why do we give pre-exposure vaccination? Well, there are obviously occupational groups that are at risk of lyssavirus and hence rabies exposure, such as diagnosticians, rabies researchers, veterinarians, cavers, etc. And so the reason one provides rabies vaccination is in theory, to provide some level of vaccination, of immunological support to individuals at risk who may be inadvertently exposed. Obviously, not every veterinarian gets boosted every time they're bitten or scratched, and they obviously aren't euthanizing all their client animals with the multitude of times that this occurs. In addition, because these individuals are at risk, it simplifies post-exposure management by and large. So it's not as if we believe that this is a magic bullet and that one is provided protection per se, but obviously being good Pasteurians, we understand these are highly potent vaccines. These are some of the best biologicals we have in both human and veterinary vaccinology as far as their potency, and at least from the animal end, these are some of the few veterinary biologicals that are actually licensed in regards to efficacy, not just in regards to immunogenicity. As far as post-exposure prophylaxis, it is as it implies. It is for the naive individuals who are exposed or potentially exposed. It consists, importantly, of wound care. We often forget this, but obviously this takes out a lot of the potential viral load, the viral burden that's been inoculated into those wounds, as well as a whole variety of foreign substances, including bacteria. We're very much concerned about flora in different animals' mouths. So one would think at a minimum the standard 15 minutes of wound washing, at the very least with water, if not soap and water. Whether or not one provides viricidals is really open to speculation. We'd be happy if it's adequate soap and water or whatever the modicum is for common wound care at the current time. In addition, the infiltration of rabies immune globulin. Infiltration means at the site as opposed to in the buttocks, if one thinks of why we're providing RIG. And if we go ahead and combine these three, wound care, rabies immune globulin, and the first of multiple doses of rabies vaccines, survivorship is virtually assured if it is both prompt and proper. The biologicals that we're talking about, they're the same as far as vaccines that are used for both pre- and post-exposure prophylaxis, and rabies immune globulin is used only in PEP. Next, please. We have three rabies vaccines licensed in the United States. Unfortunately, the RVA vaccine, previously manufactured by Michigan Department of Health, Michigan Biologicals, Bioport, is no longer available, which means we only have two currently licensed vaccines. We're in relatively good shape compared to most of the world where nerve tissue-based vaccines are still being used. We have two, the classical human diploid cell vaccine, which first became licensed on or about 1980, and shortly thereafter, the purified chick embryo cell vaccine, with both of their proprietary names listed on the slide. Intradermal application by HDC, the used to be available for pre-exposure vaccination. This was a relatively effective and economical way to get relatively large numbers of individuals, such as veterinary students who were at risk, vaccinated relatively inexpensively. Unfortunately, that is no longer available. Oftentimes, because of the economics involved, post-exposure prophylaxis intradermally is oftentimes routinely practiced in many developing countries. Next, please. In regards to rabies immune globulin, this is plasma that's taken from human volunteers. There are two products that are licensed, both Imagam as well as Hyperrab. Both are supplied in vials of 150 IU per milliliter, and these are supplied, at least in regards to the dosage administrations in both adult as well as pediatric vials, 2 mil versus 10 mil vials. For pre-exposure vaccination, the next slide, the vaccine is given on days 0, 7, and 21 or 28. Serology for those who are at risk occurs every 6 months to 2 years. For example, those individuals such as ourselves who are exposed on a continuous basis, meaning we're working with rabies virus on a daily basis, would occur every 6 months, as opposed to most individuals at common exposure levels such as veterinarians. It would occur at every two-year intervals. If one has an adequate titer, then no routine booster is needed. When one's virus-neutralizing antibody titer falls below a minimum, they would receive a single intramuscular booster. Now, I don't know how it got taken out of context, but there are no such things as rabies protective titers. We can talk about immunoprotective complexes, and obviously protection against rabies is complex. When we go ahead and vaccinate, we're talking about a whole suite of cytokines beyond virus neutralizing antibodies. All we're looking for is an adequate titer that's been internationally defined, and the bar is set relatively high because at the time, as a legacy, that people were first learning how to measure serologically virus neutralizing antibodies, laboratories were having problems in regards to backgrounds and baseline. In the United States, a minimum titer is complete neutralization at a titer of 1 to 5. At the WHO level, that's 0.5 international units per mil. If a previously vaccinated person is ever exposed, two vaccine doses are given intramuscularly, no need for RIG. These are given on days 0 and 3. Again, because of the excellent potency of these biologicals and what we know historically, that if people have a history of vaccination of either of these licensed products or having had a cell culture product elsewhere or a demonstrable titer elsewhere, by and large, these are very, very long-lived antibodies, and certainly one is primed, and hence we get questions all the time about, well, I received the vaccine in 1980, I don't know what my titer is. Should I get a titer? Do I need to get RIG? If one is a normal, healthy adult, and based on that time frame, we know that cell culture vaccines were in use in the United States, then one does not need RIG or multiple doses beyond those two. Next, please. In regards to post-exposure prophylaxis, the importance, again, on proper wound care, why does one infiltrate rabies immune globulin at the site of the lesion? Well, in theory, that's where most of the depot is in regards to rabies virus. Taken another way, if we think of a bottle of distilled water and an ink drop, as you drop that concentrated, for example, blue or India ink into that water, it begins to diffuse. But the most concentrated aspect of that is exactly where that ink first hits the water. It's the same relatively simple context in regards to rabies immune globulin. We want most of that infiltrated in and about the lesion itself. And yes, we recognize problems, for example, on fingers, noses, appendages such as the tip of the ear, whereby we want to avoid compartment syndrome. But oftentimes, you'd be surprised, up to a mil carefully can be infiltrated actually into the wound itself. We also recognize that rabies immune globulin is probably the only biological, if we think of local anesthetics, that's infiltrated locally. And so oftentimes people feel uncomfortable about that. If one can't infiltrate as much as is necessary because it's administered on a per weight basis, and we recognize the obesity epidemic that's going on, then obviously one should administer the rest of it in a lean muscle mass. And so, for example, if one was bitten on the left finger, as much should be infiltrated into the left finger, and then the remainder in the left deltoid with vaccine being administered in a different syringe and in the right deltoid. We try to avoid large fat depots such as the buttocks. And vaccine is administered on days 0, 3, 7, 14, and 28. Next, please. Obviously, we're concerned about rabies and the post-exposure management and the epidemiological record since human rabies immune globulin came on board with cell culture vaccines post-1980. We have not had a single post-exposure failure in the United States, recognizing many of these are not bona fide exposures, but recognizing that many of them are. And so this is a huge track record demonstrating the efficacy of these biologicals when appropriately applied. We have to recognize this is an urgency. We don't want to either become lackadaisical, meaning wait, nor do we want to go ahead and consider that they immediately have to be done right now. And so these are urgencies as opposed to emergencies. The true emergency, if you will, is the first aid in regards to the wound washing as opposed to waiting for that to occur. And so if a patient happens to call, obviously, that first aid measure of soap and water should be done immediately. Post-exposure prophylaxis obviously is going to depend in part on the species of animal, the epidemiological situation in that particular area. For example, what you would do in Georgia is different than what you might do in Hawaii. It's also based in part upon whether we have the ability for enhanced surveillance and the rapidity for diagnostic follow-up or observation of the biting animal. And then obviously consultation with many of your colleagues in the local and state health departments is suggested because they are the ones who hold the best latest information in regards to the local epidemiology of rabies. Everything that we're aware of on a national or regional basis, we have to depend upon the local reporting and the enhanced surveillance at the local level to know what is going on. And the reason the surveillance reports are behind is because we don't close the surveillance year until March of the year thereafter to allow time for the localities and the states to get their final tallies together. Next, please. In regards to adverse reactions, again, these are very, very safe biologicals compared to nerve tissue-based vaccines or even the products we had in the 1950s and the 1960s. Post-exposure prophylaxis should not be interrupted for mild local or mild systemic signs, and obviously becomes a gray area when they appear, at least on a temporal basis, to be more serious. These are handled always on a case-by-case basis. Oftentimes, over-the-counter medications can be used to control pain, fever, etc., and that we have to recognize that any suggested potentially serious adverse reactions should be reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, or VAERS. Next, please, what I'm going to do next is go through a series of case reports. Ideally, what I'm trying to do is go through these on a rhetorical basis to allow us at least 15 minutes for questions at the end, either for anything that I may have said that was unclear, or to allow questions about any of the case reports that we'll go through, or any other questions that might be pressing out there. The Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the 1990 Human Rabies Prevention Document, is a living document, and the broad guidelines that are out there really have not changed beyond some of the things that we've already discussed this afternoon. And a lot of these things, if the weird can happen, it does in regards to nature and living in the USA and the way that people get exposed to rabies. So a lot of the situations that we're faced with is first trying to define if they're exposures or not, and what the relative severity may be. A lot of times it has to do with what kind of animal the exposure occurred with and whether or not it's a dog or a cat or a ferret, and it is amenable to observation and hence would negate the necessity for post-exposure prophylaxis, as well as corrections when the patient doesn't appear on time or oftentimes delivery errors occur. Next, please. First case report is one that happens all the time. Somebody's jogging and they're bitten by your neighborhood, your neighborhood wonderful AKC registered dog. And oftentimes we get into semantics, was this provoked or not? Well, from the dog's standpoint, it was provoked. From the person's standpoint, it may not be. In a situation like this, where you've got a multiply vaccinated dog in a relatively well-heeled neighborhood and establishment, probably good local animal control authorities, and that animal can be observed, is one concerned? Well, I mean, beyond treating the animal bite wound, I would not be concerned about rabies in this situation. One would hope in the vast majority of situations of dog bite in the United States that the animal is available for observation. We know both from laboratory studies as well as epidemiological observations that dogs, cats, and ferrets can be observed for a period of 10 days. If the animal shows no signs of rabies during that period, the person is not deemed to have been exposed to rabies over that period. If the animal shows any clinical signs of rabies based upon inspection by a competent veterinarian, the animal is euthanized, its head is removed, its brain is extracted, and is sent to the diagnostic laboratory, who should be able to give you turnaround time events in 24 to 48 hours to allow you to make your decision. The animal remains normal over that period. Obviously, no post-exposure prophylaxis is needed. These are some of the easiest, most obvious ones, and yet we often forget about the situation. Case report number two is one that just occurred last week. I spoke with length at the with a clinician in Mississippi. This is a different situation, different not only geographically, but also in substance, because here you have a very experienced person in terms of knowing his animals and knowing his trade, and he was very concerned about the demeanor of this animal. The animal was not vaccinated. It was quite unruly, and even though Mississippi is somewhat highlighted as being one of the few states in the U.S. only to have, knock on wood, rabies in bats, this individual was very concerned about rabies, thought the animal acted in a very unusual manner, unfortunately ran out into the street, which in theory could be part of prodromal acute neurologic phase, was obliterated by a tractor trailer, and then thereafter the animal was buried. Now, under ideal conditions, could this animal be exhumed, and could one, if in fact be able to identify central nervous system, could we come up with a definitive diagnosis? One would hope yes, but in this situation it wasn't possible. And if one considers probably many of the people on this call who had administered prophylaxis for much less, given the circumstances of the exposure, meaning the way the animal presented, and the individual themselves, that they know their trade, that they know this particular animal, it would be a much different situation in regards to recommendation of prophylaxis, if for no other reason, for palliative reasons, to ease the peace of mind of this particular individual who was exposed. Case report number three. Oftentimes happens, again, a lot. Seemingly normal animals by well-intentioned individuals, cat scratch. One is very hard-pressed to go into the literature and find a bona fide document, and when I say documented, I mean a competent laboratory who actually documents that the animal in question had rabies. Bona fide demonstration of rabies acquisition by scratches. Most of the time, if we're concerned about scratches, it is with felids because of their grooming situation. Oftentimes in rabies, animals will stop grooming, and so the situation becomes, could the animal have contaminated its claws with some of that ropey saliva? Well, in theory, yes. If that was the case, and given that rabies in cats outnumbers and has rabies cases in domestic dogs in the United States, one would have thought by now acquisition of scratch would have been documented. Hence, in an area of the country such as the Pacific Northwest, which for the most part is quiescent except for rabies and bats, and in an otherwise provoked situation, that is, well-intentioned person, and in an otherwise healthy cat that's not available, it would not be unwarranted not to prophylax and beyond providing wound care in this situation. And discussion over both the epi and the situation of non-bite exposures rarely causing rabies, it would not be unwarranted not to administer prophylaxis in case report number three. In case report number four, oftentimes people are new, it might be their first night on the job, and rabies could be considered something new and exciting and mysterious, and oftentimes many of us are arithmetically challenged. And along a similar line of this case report, in some children that were recently exposed, an ER person who could not find a lesion, since it was alleged to have been a bat exposure, went ahead and administered 20-plus small doses of Rig all over the children's body in trying to be dutiful in thinking that there could be a bat bite somewhere. In a situation such as this, whereby Rig and not five doses of vaccine were administered, one is oftentimes faced with what to do. One is usually suggested to take a coarse-grained approach, and that is, what's the nature of the exposure? In situations like this, whereby someone is potentially exposed, and bat exposures, potential exposures, are some of our most contentious. Oftentimes, it has to do with some public health communications with the patient. And oftentimes, the ACIP recommendations are taken out of context. And oftentimes, it gets repeated incorrectly, verbatim to us. Well, CDC says that when a person's in a room with a bat, they should receive prophylaxis. No, that's not what the ACIP says, nor was that ever our intent throughout the 1990s, nor to date. That is, most bats are not rabid. Even those obviously suggestively ill bats that are submitted, only 5 to 14% of the obviously ill bats that are submitted come back rabid. What the suggestion is, in particular situations like this, where we're invading the bat's turf, as opposed to we never have bats in our house, and a bat was found there and was squeaking and banging into the walls and vocalizing, etc. In situations where a person wakes up and sees a bat, particularly at this time of the year, drought conditions in many parts of the country, normal time of the year for young bats to be trying their wings, situations where they're not acting abnormally, and in situations where we can get an adequate history, that is, the person is not overtly somnolent. This is not an individual of a crying baby waking up with a down bat in the room that is discarded, not someone who is celebrating the last few days before going back to school and is otherwise intoxicated or under the effects of any medication. If we can get a competent history, and if we can talk to the person, and we recognize that some people are adverse to taking any risks, both physician and patient, and that oftentimes we don't have in care management a lot of time to discuss these issues, hence referral and discussion and dialogue with people in public health. It may be quicker to write a script. That at least in the vast majority of cases when we discuss, put things into context, discuss what we know about the facts about rabies and bats, the epi data, where they exist, and ask individuals Are you an otherwise normal individual? Would you have awoken if you had a sharp prick, as you might get from a pair of forceps? Most individuals say, oh yeah, I don't think I'm at risk. They may elect for their children, even after thorough examination, not being able to find small lesions. Oftentimes, healthy, competent adults will elect not to receive prophylaxis. And so this is a judgment call. If any of those preconditions exist, and the individual says, oh, I'm a real deep sleeper, oh no, you know, we had a couple of six-packs, or, well, you know, I did find a couple small lesions, and I'm really a deep sleeper and would have noticed it, you'd probably go one way, as opposed to, after trying to put some of these things in context, somebody may elect not to receive prophylaxis, and that would not be a bad judgment call in this gray area for number four. In regards to case report number five, this has to do with what happens when somebody started on something potentially bizarre abroad. Well, unless you know that these people have rabies antibodies on board because you're at a state that can do a stat serology, oftentimes in a situation like this where you don't know what they got started on, it's best to go ahead and initiate prophylaxis from scratch, meaning if there's still a wound, wound care, infiltration of rig, and vaccine, particularly from a dog and zoonotic country. Case report number six. This always happens. It's usually a long weekend. Diagnostic turnover should be rapid to support the initiation of prophylaxis or not. One should not be waiting 5 to 7 days for diagnostic results, particularly in an unprovoked bite from a recognized reservoir. And so in a situation like this where you know there's going to be more than a 24 to 48 hour period of time, it certainly is sound to initiate prophylaxis whenever you strongly suggest or believe rabies may be the case, as in this situation from skunk bite. In terms of number seven, what happens when the person doesn't come back on time? They may have been mixed up in terms of their prescription form, bona fide bite by rabid animals. What you should do is initiate vaccination on the day they appear and then continue the series. And so, for example, when they appear on day 21, you give them the fourth dose and have them appear 14 days later. So keep the interval spacing the way it is by and large. Case report number eight. We are not concerned about rodent bites. Again, if I'd be a rich person if I had stock in prophylaxis for everybody bitten by rodents. Rodents are not reservoirs. We don't really understand why. Tens of thousands of rodents have been examined. Occasionally, some will be found rabid. For example, situations such as groundhog and beaver, relatively large-bodied rodents, unprovoked situations. However, most routine rodent bites such as this, they're not reservoirs. There are no documented, quote-unquote, cases of human rabies acquisition after rodent bite. So prophylaxis is not warranted most often after routine rodent bite. In terms of number nine, somebody comes to you with an ELISA titer of 1 to 5, that is less than 1 to 5, 2 years after primary pre, you go ahead and give them a booster. Well, number one, it's an ELISA titer versus we've been talking about rabies virus neutralizing antibody titers of 0.5 IU internationally or complete neutralization at 1 to 5. And so one would want to know what is their rabies virus neutralizing antibody titer before you would make a decision. If the VNA titer comes back higher than complete neutralization at 1 to 5, obviously they wouldn't need a booster, as opposed to if it was lower, they would. In the last case report, number 10, the person comes in with vaccine A a long time ago, and now they've cut themselves during a necropsy on a suspect animal. Well, if you can get diagnostic results, that'll help determine your decision. If the animal comes back positive, do you need to go and find RVA vaccine? No. And so if they know they've gotten vaccine A and you have access to licensed vaccine B, you would, if warranted, go ahead and administer 2 booster doses in case report number 10. I think at this point, in the interest of time, we'll open it up to questions, either from anything from the case reports, the presentations, or any burning questions people may have. Thank you.
Thank you. To ask a question at this time, please press star 1. To withdraw your question, you may press star 2. Once again, to ask a question, please press star 1. First question comes from Catherine Brown. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Ruprecht. Thanks for that discussion on bats. That was actually really helpful. My question is,
when you find a bat out in the hallway outside of a sleeping person's open door, do you have the same discussion with them, or do you consider it sort of irrelevant because it wasn't found in the same room?
Thanks very much. That's an excellent gray area question. And in fact, we actually had that happen with our previous NCID director. They actually found the rabid bat outside of their hallway. His wife was not concerned. He was relatively concerned. Upon a great deal of discussion, when one goes through the issues of normal, healthy adults, somnolent or not, medications on board, etc., even in situations like that, majority of people, after consultation, you can put them at ease, suggest, no, I think I would feel a bite such as that if I was asleep. Oftentimes when we're thinking about the bat scenarios, most often we're thinking about same time, same place. And so then it can go from the hallway to the next floor to the basement, etc. It really, by and large, comes back to the same situation when you have the bat in hand and it's found positive. Are you concerned about the ability of that individual to be able to detect a bite exposure? If you are, prophylaxis would be the key. If not, a lot of these people, you'd be surprised, you can talk down.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Robert Deben. Ask a question.
Yeah, I have a question about bat biologists. This is Dr. Deben. The question has come up how often they need a booster every time they're exposed or get bitten, which, of course, isn't the case. But I answered their question by saying they need to get their titers checked and every 2 years at least, and then act on that basis. Is that correct?
Thanks. That's an excellent question, and this is another huge conundrum. Certainly, this is a population at risk that we certainly would recommend highly that they have routine titer testing and routine boosters when their titers fall below a minimum. What we would suggest strongly is that such individuals, and we realize they're a special population, I was one of them, that they consider personal protection equipment, such at least as a glove on one hand or a glove as a baffles, because oftentimes during a busy season, they will be sometimes bitten repeatedly on a single night or on the course of several days. One would also be surprised, oftentimes they're a pretty good judge of behavior of what seems abnormal to them, but we have to, and submit the animal, but we have to recognize that oftentimes animals can be acting completely normal, and in the prodrome will be excreting virus. So in situations like that, we recommend routine titer testing, boosters when this is out of the ordinary, meaning this is usually a very good person at handling, and an animal bites them. Bite to an experienced bat biologist is a concern, and encouragement of PPE. If this is something that continues to occur, that is, despite advising, serological testing, boosters, PPE, etc., we suggest some remediation, particularly in graduate student situations. Obviously, in democracies and with adults, we realize that there's relatively little that can be done. But in academic settings, in settings where people are using bats for research, when this happens, particularly in novitiates, in the people who are being trained, and their supervisor is not responsible, then certainly one may need to take some other administrative action to make sure that we don't wind up with a case. Thank you very much for the question.
You bet.
Our next question comes from Robert Ball.
Hi, Chuck. Robert Ball, South Carolina. Excellent presentation. I have a question regarding infiltration of rabies immune globulin in around the site of the bite. Considering the rabies virus moves centripetally about a centimeter a day, does it make sense to infiltrate proximally to the site of the bite or just in the site of the bite?
Thanks. That's an excellent question. And certainly if there were multiple bites, say, from a finger to a hand and an arm and onto the deltoid, that's what one would be doing anyway. Part of the problem, I think, and particularly in children, say with a finger bite by a bat, if one goes ahead and infiltrates locally, and then one goes ahead and administers, based on what volume you can, into the deltoid, at least you've caught it at its inception and potentially at a place that it's going to go and move and diffuse anyway. Part of the problem with going proximal, for example, on the lower arm, is having enough muscle mass. So you certainly would if there were lesions there, but aside from that, perhaps most infiltration, and I know we get into active discussions with a lot of our colleagues in developing countries saying they can always infiltrate the maximum amount in a finger. Well, with a 100-kilo person and, say, a bat bite or a cat scratch on the finger, that becomes relatively difficult, I think, to put multiple mils in and around a finger. Deltoid would be a next best site, and I really haven't heard of anyone, even though it's come up for discussion multiple times, as to whether or not it would be administered appropriately, whether the muscle mass in the lower arm would be able to accommodate what you would otherwise administer, say, up in the deltoid.
And should we be now avoiding the gluteus for the remaining rig that cannot be infiltrated locally?
Very much so. Whatever one can try to avoid administration, particularly with the obesity epidemic, quote-unquote, in those adipose pockets into the gluteals would certainly be well served.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Donna. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. I have two questions. The first question is, if somebody's received all five doses of the post-exposure prophylaxis and they have an exposure, say, 2 years later, what kind of follow-up is needed for them?
Two doses, 0 and 3.
So, okay, always 0 and 3. The other is more of is an exposure that I want an opinion on. It actually happened to my family. We had a bat in the backyard. I have 2 dogs and a cat. Don't know if any of them were exposed, brought them in, but it was right up to the house. Bat did test positive for rabies. It was animal control, picked it up, tested it. They quarantined my animals for 45 days, and no one could give us any specific information as to whether we needed post-exposure because they didn't take the animals for at least a week until...
Sorry, you should have called your state health department or given us a buzz.
Called everybody.
Your animals should have been properly boosted and observed for 45 days if they were previously vaccinated. As far as you're concerned, unless you guys had direct exposure to the bat, you're not considered exposed, and oftentimes a lot of prophylaxis goes on for the person who touched the dog that fought with the bat that, you know, lived in the house at Johnville. Certainly, we are concerned about the individual animals exposed if they develop rabies exposures to family members, but there have never been any documented cases of indirect non-bite exposures that have resulted in cases in humans anywhere in the world.
Okay, so the vaccines that we all took weren't needed then.
Look at it this way. You're ready to go ecotourism in Sub-Saharan Africa.
There you go. Okay. Yeah, that would be, and so basically on those kind of situations with a positive bat and an animal, it is that is current on rabies, it's normal for them to go ahead and quarantine those animals?
Immediate booster vaccinations and 45-day observation periods. It varies from state to state, locality to locality as to the seriousness of the confinement. A lot of the my colleagues would just say, just be aware of it, and when they're confined, it means you're not, well, one should never be letting your animals stray, but that should be under leash confinement. Some people suggest confinement in the home. Confinement is very liberally interpreted in the 50 states of the U.S.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Victor Kopner. Check your mute button. Victor Kovner, your line is open.
Yes, this is Vic Kovner. I'm in the San Diego area. I recently saw a young lady who rescues bats. She was bitten by a rabid bat. She had a 5.35 ELISA titer approximately 1 year before the exposure. I gave her rabies immunization on day 0 and day 3, and she asked me, how long can I go without a booster if I get bitten by a bat over the next 2 or 3 months?
Excellent question, and I know most states that allow rehabilitation of suspect reservoir or vector species demand that any bites of those animals be summarily euthanized and submitted for testing.
Well, the bat was submitted and was rabid.
And in situations like that, we hope, very similar to the previous question, we hope that these individuals are using appropriate PPE as well as remedial training. And after recommendations, PPE, remedial training, if these things continue to occur, one should suggest a change in avocation, in my opinion. But as far as how long one waits, it obviously becomes and strains credibility if this were to occur say, on a daily basis for a week during a busy season, as opposed to every 6 months or every season or every year, then one would still administer boosters, but you're not going to be administering boosters every day. And so we've got to be able to interpret beyond the recommendations of offering adequate prophylaxis while understanding immunological terms that we're only going to boost to a particular point and thereafter one will not boost. And in fact, thereafter we run the risk of heightened adverse events and potentially sensitization such that people who would be at risk would no longer respond. And we know of at least several documented non-responders because they got boosted too often. So in a situation like that, it's a real gray area, and I think you've got at least a couple of things at your disposal. We have to recognize that although virus-neutralizing antibodies determined by virus-neutralizing antibody titers as opposed to serology can be very, very long-lived, but we also all have to recognize that there are a whole suite of other immune effectors, such as cytokines, that are taken into effect, and since they're much more shorter-lived, we get an anamnestic response when a booster occurs. So adequate boosters when they occur, but we can't go ahead and strain that towards the ridiculous.
Okay. She does wear gloves. This is a baby bat, and it's the first time she's been bitten with years of exposure. So thank you.
Let's hope it doesn't occur.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Barry Armstrong. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. A question about pre-exposure vaccination. I am a pediatrician and run a travel clinic in San Jose, California. We have a lot of children visiting friends and relatives in India. And would you recommend the vaccine, the pre-exposure vaccine for those children?
Excellent question. And you know it's a special case for children. Part of it depends. If they're relatives are the sort that they know they're only going to be going from the plane to the taxi to a condo or a house, you know, that's one thing. If they know they're going to be true tourists, they're going to be out and about in the streets, then we know what's going to happen. They're going to be normal kids. Even though we tell them not to touch, we know what often will happen. They will touch, and they may not tell us. So in situations such as where you know that they are going to be out and about being tourists, in a developing country with hyperendemic rabies, dog rabies such as in India, I think it would be warranted to offer pre-exposure, particularly to children, and at the same time have the normal do's, don'ts, since we know an awful lot of our tourists invite prophylaxis themselves. Oh, let's take a picture with a monkey on our shoulder situation.
Right. And have you encountered in your experience many travelers or kids with rabies returning to the U.S.? I know, you know, working in travel, I'm aware of some cases around the world, but what's your experience in the U.S.?
There was one very celebrated case. This was a very well-traveled woman who was in Nepal and, of course, woke
right.
The sleeping dog, got bitten, traveled to Thailand, unfortunately did not receive prophylaxis, even though we have the excellent Thai Red Cross there in Bangkok. Thereafter, traveled to Australia, which did have biologicals, but she didn't wait. Came back to the U.S., and when she described the situation, again, because of some confusion, her physician said, oh, it happened X period of time ago. Oh, you would have had rabies by now. Don't worry about it. And unfortunately, she did develop rabies.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next question comes from Brian Cherry. Your line is open.
Hi, Dr. Ruprecht. Thanks for having this program. I wanted to ask you, I know we've actually talked about this before, but just maybe you could clarify again for me and for everyone else. You were talking about misadministration of RIG in particular, not wanting to put it in hand wounds and so on. When we find out, and unfortunately this is too common here, that a physician did not infiltrate for any of those reasons, gave the vaccine, it's now 1-2 days later, and we find this out, what do you recommend? Is it worth going back and infiltrating that wound? Where's the balance there? And actually, on the heels of a previous question from a caller about RIG in the gluteal, if we find out that they actually did that, would you ever recommend readministering the RIG?
Sure. Thanks very much. Excellent question. Depending on the severity of the exposure, if we know we've got bona fide rabid animal, we've got multiple severe lesions, and particularly when we have them about the face and head or highly innervated areas such as hands, and it's early on, i.e. you catch it within a few days. Certainly within those first few days, it would be customary, perhaps, to consider re-infiltration of the wounds if they weren't properly infiltrated, and certainly if the rig went into a potential depot, such as in the gluteals. If it occurs, you know, after 7 days, we've already got virus neutralizing antibodies starting on board from your immunization from 0, 3, and 7, it probably would be less warranted. So really, depending on severity and location and timing when one discovers it, there are relatively few times when you would consider restarting in a situation such as you suggest, but particularly severe wounds in some locations such as those, I think it would be warranted to re-infiltrate in those first few days with bona fide bite exposures.
Our next question goes from Julian Wang.
Yes, hello. I'm from Ontario, Canada. Thank you very much for your presentation. I have a couple of questions. If someone's had a pre-exposure series in the past, is it true that no matter how much time has passed, they're re-exposed, they only still need only 2 doses of the vaccine on days 0 and 3?
That's correct. By current ACIP and even WHO standards, if it is with the current lot of cell culture vaccines, and so if one were to tell you, oh, I was vaccinated back in the military in 1945, well, you know, all bets are off in a situation like that, as opposed to if you know what country they're in and they're from a developed country and it's post-1980 in particular, we know in the clear majority of cases in developed countries that only cell culture vaccines were licensed. In situations like that, it's certainly true as long as you know you have a normal, healthy adult. Now, if there are situations where you're not sure, it's always better to err on the side of caution unless you can have a titer taken. So either with the knowledge of a previous rabies virus neutralizing antibody titer that can be documented at any time, documentation of what type of modern cell biological they received, and as long as that person appears, to all intents and purposes, to be a normal, healthy, immunocompetent adult, that is true. That individuals who receive...
Thank you. A coordinator will assist you momentarily.
Pre-exposure prophylaxis back in the 80s, you would still only administer 2 doses, 0 and 3.
Okay, thanks very much. And just a quick follow-up question. Let's say in that case you weren't too sure and you want to take a blood titer. Is it also true that no matter how long it's been since they got the pre-series, that or a post-series, post-exposure series, that you can trust the blood titer result?
Again, if you're going to a CLIA bona fide laboratory, you should be able to appreciate those results, and in fact, oftentimes they'll be sky high. Now, if it's an issue of health, if it's a question, for example, they were Peace Corps volunteers and received intradermal vaccination, cell culture vaccination, if they had a variety of other immunizations such as anti-malarials on board at the same time, that certainly may be taken into question. But at least in our experience, the vast majority of times, cell culture biologicals, normal healthy adults, intramuscular administration, rarely have we found people to fall to an inadequate level. And certainly if we look at people such as our staff here, we've never had anybody in our rabies group since I've been here fall below an adequate titer.
Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Aaron Chester. Your line is open.
Is there any information about the risk from opossum bites as a marsupial?
Yes, very good question. Opossums, even though they are quite widely distributed up from South and Central America into the U.S. and now into parts of Southern Canada, opossums are very peculiar. They're relatively resistant to rabies. In fact, in one comparative study, you can put in 50,000 times the amount of rabies it took to kill a fox, and possums are still laughing at you. We only have relatively few opossum cases that are found positive every year. And so given the relative distribution and abundance and how relatively few possums that we find positive and their relative resistance even to experimental challenge, it wouldn't be common for one to recommend prophylaxis in situations with a possum bite. Obviously, it's always best if one can to submit tests etc. But when that animal's not available, I don't believe the majority of people are recommending prophylaxis after routine possum bite, particularly when the animal bite was provoked seemingly or they appeared otherwise, you know, quote unquote normal, although that obviously strains the imagination in an opossum.
Our next question is Catherine Brown. Your line is open. You may ask your question.
I apologize for revisiting this, but this question of re-exposure actually comes up all the time, and I feel like maybe I could use a little bit more clarification. So we have someone that just finished their post-exposure series, and they are then bitten again by, let's say, a confirmed rabid animal. Now, you know, 6 months later, I would say, okay, certainly they need to get another, they need to get boosted. But what if it's a month after they just finished their original series? You know, are they in an immunologically normal adult? How long time would you say that first series is probably good for?
Excellent question. And there's a couple of different ways to approach this. From a medical legal standpoint, in a situation such as you described, previously vaccinated, 1 month later, I would follow the letter of the ACIP and boost. From an immunological perspective, if this was an otherwise normal, healthy adult, there's relatively little good that boosting does within a month period of time when we know they either just got the full post-exposure prophylaxis series or the complete boosters after a prior full series or pre-exposure on board. So one is caught between the situation of the medico-legal versus the immunological. If one would hope that this is a rare event in that individual, meaning we're not talking about the animal rehabilitator, this is an individual that for whatever reason just recently got exposed, I think one should probably err on the side of caution from a medical legal standpoint alone, because we can't control sometimes for the severity of the exposure whether or not in fact frank virus could be introduced at or directly or near nervous tissue. We can't control for the variant. And we certainly know that, for example, let's suppose this was abroad as opposed to the United States. There are variants throughout the world that the relative cross-reactivity with traditional biologicals is less than ideal. So, you know, I hate to say it, but it depends. But I think when pressed, and this is a unique situation for that individual, it would probably be best to err on the side of caution.
Thanks. That actually helps a lot.
Thank you.
Our next question is from Donald Neal. Your line is open.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. I'm Donnie Neal. I'm down on the east coast of North Carolina. My question comes to you, and I believe it was briefly touched on earlier, about concomitant administration of the vaccine with antimalarials. As you can imagine, what we have going on down in this area. My question to you is, do you need to wait a certain period of time before you give the antimalarials after the pre-exposure, or can you give them concomitantly?
Thank you. Good question. And this came up earlier historically when lower relative amounts of antigen were being administered intradermally. And it certainly is still relevant in many indigenous parts of the world where intradermal vaccination with rabies is still practiced. However, since we no longer have licensed products for ID, we have not had documented interference with intramuscular doses of vaccine. They're the only ones that are currently licensed in the U.S., and so there should not be a cause for concern that we are aware of with concomitant use of antimalarials and intramuscular doses of currently licensed human rabies vaccines.
I apologize to anyone who is not able to ask a question. For those of you who still have questions or if you want a clarification, please email us at coca@cdc.gov. That is coca@cdc.gov. And we will try to connect with Dr. Ruprecht and get those questions answered for you. And I just really want to thank Dr. Ruprecht for providing our listeners with this information. I think this was a wonderful
talk, and I know that everyone gained a lot of valuable information. So thanks again, and remember that's COCA@cdc.gov.
Thank you.
Today's call has concluded. All parties may disconnect.